it's a tough situation because people who live in the suburbs tend to live like this. That's out there. Well, I'm telling you right now, this room should be full to standing room only, because what they don't realize is it's right next door. How many did you say went through safe passages? 100, 150? In this area alone. And that's the people that actually went to safe passages. That's the people that were actually ready. And I'm sure that Dave can share stories and other people in this room can share stories about the fact that there are people hurting. Bob sees them every day. You know, they're encountered multiple times. They need to know that we care and that the help is there. Yep.
Rotary Hall, every now and then I see on Facebook where they post how many people have died since the first of the year. And as of February 28th, there was 156 deaths in Cuyahoga County.
And what was that date?
February 28th.
And that's not just in the inner cities.
No,
that's our neighbors. That's people around us. That's coworkers, family members of coworkers, people around us that are hurting. We need to open our eyes and just reach out to people. And, you know, one of the greatest opportunities for me to grow in my knowledge and stuff was a breakaway that they had in Brook Park, because that's where I'm from. And one of the featured speakers was Rob. And ever since then, I've been like, I got to get him. I got to get him here. I got to get him speaking. And I really wish there was more people here, because we're just going to have to bring him back again. But and once you hear him, you'll understand why. He's a wealth of knowledge. And he's right in the back door of our community. And he's doing such a great job to advance the education and awareness around this, not just the opiate epidemic. I mean, there's alcoholics are addicts too. We got to understand that alcohol is a drug also. Anything that alters the mind, it's an addiction. And we need to treat them all the same instead of parceling them out. That's the only way we're going to get ahead. So I'm going to have Rob come on up and share with us now.
So I'm like sitting here listening to everybody that's been up here talking so far, and I'm just kind of completely scrapping everything I put together for this and going, man, we got to go in all these different directions. And you've already heard just this incredible amount of stuff that is so critical and so vital. And but where I want to start today is with this couple here, because I can't even tell you the amount of courage that it takes to stand up in front of a room like this and to share your personal story and to say, this is our life. This is our daughter. I was sitting here going, who's the girl in the picture? Well, now I know. But round of applause, another one, because thank you. I literally have to go through my mind now and like recap everything everybody talked about, because there were so many critical things. There were so the support group. You spoke about the support group. And we look at 12-step groups for addicts, and traditionally with the A groups, you know, you've got the meetings and the leads, and they focus on the 12 steps or 8 steps or 10 steps or whatever any one of the groups has bastardized the steps to get to, any certain numbers. And if you go through the steps, right, you can condense steps and combine steps, I guess, if you want to, you know, if 12 is too many and you want to make sure you can count on your fingers and toes or just your fingers, we count it to 10, right? But you said something that was so incredibly brilliant about your group. Two things. I'll give you two things that were brilliant. First off, faith-based. Because if we look at the demographics, just look at the demographics of addiction and things like that, people that are faith-based have less incidence. The only demographic in the world with less incidence of addiction and better recovery rates. And I think in part it's because those that struggle with addiction in faith can find unconditional love, even when they can't find it at home. In faith, they can find unconditional love, forgiveness, and a pathway to move forward. So such a critical cornerstone. But the other thing that you talked about was focusing on the underlying aspects that drove addiction. Most treatment centers and most A groups focus on recovery from addiction, right? We got to do it. We critically important. But something drove the addiction. Something in their past, something somewhere drove the addiction. And the best recovery centers out there will work on those things. They'll work on both at the same time. How do we recover from addiction? But what caused this? How did you get to this point in time? And that's what we need to work on repeatedly. And unfortunately, most of our young people that are struggling with addiction, when they come out of treatment centers, aren't getting that focus in their support group, nor are they working with a psychologist. If they're not getting in their support group, are they working with a psychologist to help identify those underlying issues and help them learn how to cope, and right, your fourth C, right? We talk about coping as families, but coping as an addict, how do I cope? Because it's this lack of coping skills that really drives addiction and drives relapse. So what a wonderful group, and I can't wait to get your literature because we're going to promote you all over the place. So it'll be good. And then Barb. So Barb is part of our Robbie's Voice family, and very excited. But talking about the Safe Passages program, first off, Chief Vanyo here in the township and Chief Greckle over in Berea are longtime friends, and so they should get this disease because I've been in their ear enough about it as well. But what Barb talked about with Safe Passages and Perry is a foundational change that's taking place in our communities today. And it's this foundational change in mindset that law enforcement is going through. Like when I went to my first meeting 6 years ago with the Department of Justice, one of the officers made this comment that we can't arrest our way out of this thing. And that was 6 years ago, right? And it hasn't changed any. And it's taken a lot of time to get to this evolution within the confines of law enforcement to understand jail doesn't cure addiction. It doesn't. And so as we start to see this evolution and this movement, first off, the courage and the leadership that Chief Vanyo and Chief Greckle have showed to step up and say, yeah, we're going to do it. Of course, you know, being one's from Ignatius and one from Eds, and so they said, you know, we're not going to do it the way they did it in Massachusetts. We're going to put our own spin on it here in the community. You have that. But there's other things that are taking place within the confines of that are unique and foundational that are going to completely reshape the way we approach this, both from a law enforcement standpoint and an EMS standpoint. So what I'm talking about is that if you just go up the road to Southwest General Hospital, Dr. Tout works with the EMS team up there, was the former director of their emergency department, and you've got Oakview, and Southwest General and Oakview have combined to create a different approach to ensuring that those in recovery that come in get a bed, get treatment, and get started. You have somewhere to go until they can be moved into an appropriate treatment center. We're starting to see a big thing for Dr. Tout working with EMS is the connectivity of EMS to the family. Right, we go to the scene, EMS goes to the scene, and they respond to the addict. Sometimes with compassion, sometimes with disdain, but they respond because that's what they get paid to do. But what happens is at that scene is there's a family that's in turmoil, that's in distress. And nobody's focused on the family, right? We're focused on gathering evidence. We're focused on the life that's in day. We're focused on everything else but the family. So there's starting to be a focus on how do we start to connect the family with recovery. And we're actually talking to Chief Greckle about different ways that we can help the police connect to the families as well, so that when the crisis situation occurs, the addict is not the only one in crisis. The addict may be in physical crisis, but the family is in mental and emotional crisis. And so how do we connect to the family? And that's really what I wanted to kind of focus our attention on today, is the family. But before I do that, I mean, just, God, you guys got my mind spinning here. It's just like crazy stuff. You know, this thing we're dealing with, this thing, and when we go talk to schools, I always try and frame this for the students as to what we're dealing with, because, you know, the students, they're off in la-la land, and it's, you know, kind of dealing with their own stuff. But, you know, in our country today, you know, we've got 15% of our country addicted. We've got 48 million Americans addicted to something, all right? 23 million of them that we know of are addicted to substances. 2 million teenagers are addicted to drugs in our country today. And that number is growing and growing and growing each year. And, you know, we lose more people every year than we lost in the entire Vietnam War, right? I'm sure you've heard that statistic. 11 people in our country, or 7 people in our country die every hour. 11 people in the state of Ohio die every day. The first time I came and spoke to a school 6 years ago, it was 4. Okay, 4 people. So we've gone from 4 people every day to 7 people every day. So we got some work to do. We've got a lot to do. But we also, and before I jump into this, this is one of the things I always stress to the kids and I stress to the parents. We cannot hand off our accountability as adults and as parents in this epidemic. We live in a country that accounts for less than 5% of the world's population. Okay? And yet, and everybody in this room told their kids don't do drugs? Anybody not tell their kids don't do drugs, right? We've all told our kids don't do drugs. And then we show them everything but, right? We tell our kids don't do drugs, and yet we utilize over about 70% of the world's illegal drugs are consumed here in the United States of America, right? So over here, I'm going to tell you don't do drugs, and over here, I'm going to wrap you in this wonderful blanket of 70% of the world's illegal drugs. Over 80% of the world's pharmaceutical medications are consumed right here in the United States of America. So I'm going to tell you don't do drugs, but from the time you're old enough to remember, anytime you have an ache, a pain, or anything, I'm going to plug you with drugs. They may be legal drugs, but I'm going to teach you to take a pill, feel better, drink a liquid, feel better. And that's the mentality that I'm going to teach you from the time you're 3 years old. I'm not going to help you understand the medicine. I'm not going to help you understand the dosages or the bottles or how we take medicine or how we respect medicine. I'm going to give it to you so you quit hanging on my leg and wiping your snot all over me and you go to bed so that I can get some rest, right? And that's just kind of how we approach medications in our country. We are one of two countries in the entire civilized world, well, the entire world, period, that advertises medications on television. One of two countries. That's it. Okay? The other country is New Zealand. Do people live in New Zealand? I mean, I think the only people in New Zealand are like hobbits and movie crews, right? So this is it. We're the only two countries in the world that advertise and promote this on television. And then we as adults have taken it a step further, and you look at what's on television in the movies, right, that's plugged out there. Now, I'm going to make a confession here. It's not even a legal confession. It's just a confession. I'm a Brady Bunch freak, okay? I love the Brady Bunch. I grew up on the Brady Bunch. Watch the Brady Bunch now as an adult. Every episode of the Brady Bunch dealt with a situation a young person might face and how as a family they collectively come together to solve the problem. And then go watch Nickelodeon, the kids' network, and see what kind of programming is on TV. Go watch the other things that our kids are watching on TV and in the movies, right? And everything that they're seeing is all the drugs and this and the drinking, and it's okay, it's just kind of the way it is. You look at the music they listen to, and rap music, 75% of rap music glorifies drugs and alcohol. And yet, it's okay, go ahead and listen to that. And we're good, yeah, go listen to the rap, because we're probably not even paying attention to what they're listening to. And for all you country music fans that want to be on your high and mighty high horse, okay, let's talk about all your rowdy friends and your red solo cup, because country music is filled with two things, killing your spouse and drinking, and that's it. And sometimes they put them both into the same song. Am I right, right? All right? But in those of you that listen to 104 and 106, you think you're safe from this, but you're not, because you're in your car with your kids singing songs and letting them sing songs that you have no idea what the heck they're singing about, and yet they're singing about getting high as a G6 and scissorp and drank, and you're rocking away with the kids, and they're making drug reference throughout all these songs, and we're telling our kids it's okay. We talk about the Friday night football games and the party afterwards. Oh, there's high school drinking. Well, that's not a good thing, but it's a rite of passage, right? When my kids graduated from Olmsted Falls High School, we went to parties and the parents were saying, okay, just leave your keys and you can drink. 18-year-old kids without other parental permission. We tell our kids on a regular basis it's okay, and then we wonder why we're in this predicament that we're in. And these are the things that have to change. We have to stand up and parent. We have to look at this in a much different way. If we truly want this to stop, it's not about more treatment, it's not about more support groups, it's not about FA, HA, NA, pick an A group, go ahead. It's not about that. It's about the way we choose to approach society now. It's about the way we choose to include or exclude faith in what we do as a family. So now I'm going to get off my high horse, and we're going to talk a little bit about what I came here to talk about tonight, and then questions and answers throughout the whole thing is all good. So, all right, let's see if we get this thing to work. Are we working? Let's see. All right, here we go. Whoa, back. There we go. All right, so Robbie's voice. We started the organization 6 years ago to do just this, whether it was kids or rehabs or parents groups. I will have to say that I have only on a couple occasions had the opportunity or the privilege to address parents from an FA group or from a community. But what we started is just to come and have conversations. Let's start talking about what's going on in our communities, because most people don't know. Hence, that's why this room isn't filled, because it's never going to happen in my home, so why do I need to take my Saturday and spend 2 hours over at the Old Orchard Church, and I don't have to, because it's not going to happen in our house. So we wanted to start having those kind of conversations and helping young people understand the reality of their choices, helping moms and dads understand what was actually going on, moms and dads that didn't know what scissorp and drank was, moms and dads that didn't know what missing cotton balls meant, moms and dads that didn't know what Juicy Fruit gum and peanut butter and mini gummy bears were all about, right? Moms and dads that are living in the dark and have no clue about what all these little things truly mean and what's going on in our schools in that today. So over the course of 6 years, we've spoken to over 90,000 people about this, working to raise awareness. And by the grace of God and by the hand of God, we've been directed in a number of different directions. 2 years ago, we started our family support group in Medina called Family Matters. We are nowhere near as formal or structured as FA is. In fact, we probably break every rule of every support group that exists. But you know what it works for? We see Barb, like, she's going, yeah, we do. We have like one rule. You're only allowed to say 2 of the 7 words that you're not allowed to say on radio. We cut you some slack. The other 5 we prohibit, but pick 2 and you can use those in the group, you know. And crosstalk is permitted, and we do. But it's, you know, it's about the families coming together in support. This past summer, we were blessed to open a post-treatment community center for those in recovery, because we truly believe that was the missing link. Is okay, we're going to put you through treatment, and then what, right? So you've got great support groups like that, but that's Monday night. What do I do Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday? And we're like, we can have a place where those in recovery can come together, support each other, be in a sober environment. Wow, what a difference it would make. And it was. It's been amazing. The results have been incredible. You may have read in the newspaper somewhere along the line that our partners, which was the Medina County Courts, has decided to create a culinary program, turn it into a restaurant, and serve alcohol, at which point in time we said we're no longer going to be involved with this, and we kind of departed ways. But it worked. When we were able to bring those in recovery together, create a community of support for those who knew what each and every person was going through, they came and they supported, and it was amazing. We've been blessed to work with these organizations up here on the board. I've spoken on behalf of the United States Department of Justice. I've spoken on behalf of the Attorney General's Office on a fairly regular basis. And I actually testified before Congress in May of 2016, which is an amazing example of those that we pay a lot of money to run our country and have no clue what's going on every day in our communities. But hey, it's okay. We work very hard to get to where we're going on that. Last year, we were very, very blessed to have been selected. We're partnered with the FBI on a couple of different projects, and we were selected to be one of 57 organizations across the United States of America to be recognized in Washington, D.C., literally the week before Comey was terminated. But hey, you know, we had nothing to do with it, I promise. And I do absolutely not know any Russians that I'm aware of. What was incredible about that was that we sat in this room. Like, Gary Sinise was there, who works with veterans. And there was a 16-year-old kid there. Tom Osborne was there, who used to be the head football coach at the University of Nebraska back in their glory days. And it was intimidating. It was like, why are we here? Like, look at all these amazing people. And then my ego kicked in and said, damn it, we deserve to be here. We do a lot of good stuff. But what was incredible about that experience was simply this. It was people in a community making a difference. And that's all it was. That's your FA group. That's you standing up and talking to the other EMS workers about what's going on and the truth about this. That's the church, okay? It's people in a community coming together. And if we sit back and we think we're going to wait for the government to fix this, we are completely off our rocker, because it's not going to happen. We are about to allocate billions of dollars to the CARA program, and it's a great thing and it's a wonderful thing, and we need to do that. But it'll be misspent and spent all over the place. And $6 billion across the 50 states with the addiction that we're dealing with is really not all that much money. It's important and it's needed, but change can only happen in our communities. All right, so why are we here and how did we get into this? So for those of you that don't know, this is my son, all right? A lovely young lady, story for a different day. And they may have crossed paths at the high school at one particular point in time. When my son was between his freshman and sophomore year of high school, he had his wisdom teeth taken out. He was given a prescription for pain medication. And he did not become an addict at that particular moment. We had him off the pills in 2 days. But his brain liked the way he felt on those pills. So that year when he was at school, one of the things that we did not know as parents is that in our schools, in our high schools, it's oftentimes easier to get prescription pain medication than it is marijuana. Okay, digest that for a second. And so somebody had brought pills to school, said, hey, you know, we got these pills, you want one? And his thought process was pretty simple. I've taken them before. I like the way they made me feel. Nothing bad happened. We don't educate our kids about drugs in schools anyway. At home, we tell our kids, don't take drugs. But this isn't a drug. It's a prescription pain pill. It comes from a doctor. It's got to be safe. And he did. And that's where his addiction started. He rapidly became addicted to the pain medications and realized that he was in trouble. He did not come home and tell us about it. And because we were very smart parents and very engaged with our kids, and we would know if our kids were using drugs, we missed every warning sign under the sun. We missed the warning signs back when he had his wisdom teeth taken out, like he wanted the pills at 4 hours instead of eight, or 2 hours instead of whatever it was. The fact that, you know, he liked the way that, like, he didn't, like, get me off these pills, I don't feel good. No, he enjoyed how he felt on the pills. And when we did take him off, it was, oh, you took me off too soon, right? We missed every warning sign under the sun to some degree. Like, my wife knew something was wrong. I didn't, because my kids will never use drugs. This will never happen in my home, okay? So not only did I not see the warning signs, but frankly and candidly, I refused to see the warning signs. But I did want to appease my wife, because that's what good husbands do, right? We appease our wives. And so I did have the conversation with my son. Son, is everything okay? Yes, Dad. Are you using drugs? No, Dad. Okay, great. Here's $20. Go have a good day. And that was the extent of the father-son conversation on drugs, aside from don't do drugs. So that's how he went through high school, is that he knew he was in trouble, so he tried to stop. But, you know, hey, guess what we got? And the text would come through. And so he was on and off and on and off and on and off and on and off. And the signs that we missed, though, were, you know, didn't want to get out of bed in the morning. Well, he just won't get out of bed. He's 16. Why would he want to get out of bed? He's 7. Why would he want to get out of bed in the morning? He had mood changes. Oh, he's a teenager, right? He's, you know, come on. He changed friends often. We just didn't know enough to be able to dig in deep and understand all the little things that were going on. Like, you know, my wife would say, hey, why are our cotton balls missing? Why? God, I can't believe I'm going through cotton balls like water. What's going on? Oh, man, if we had known in that moment. He went through his first year of college, spent all his money, went broke, but his dream was to be in the military. We talked him out of it because there was this little thing called the war going on. So we had made him go to college, but he said, Mom, Dad, I'm going to the military. Well, you know what? It's your dream. You know, what do dads always say? It'll make you a man, so go for it. And he did, and somehow or another, he was able to get himself clean enough to pass the drug test. He wanted to go to the military because it was his dream, but he knew it would take him away from all the people that kept pulling him back into use. So he spent 3 months at basic training, and he was drug-free, and he was clean, and he was healthy, living his dream. He spent the next 3 months at advanced training, and when he returned home, he was in the National Guard, so it was going to the monthly weekend thing. When he returned home, he ran into an old friend, and that old friend said, hey, do you remember when we used to do these pills together? His brain went haywire. Yes, I remember. What a feeling it was. I got this new drug. Okay, well, I can do that new drug once because, man, I really want that feeling again. I'll never be an addict again. I won't go down that road again. I know what that was all about. That'll never happen again. And he said yes, and within 2 weeks, he was fully addicted to heroin. It didn't take us long this time to figure out something wasn't right. You don't just fall asleep at the kitchen table with a sloppy Joe in your hand, right? There were just too many things going on. And then one night, while he was away in a National Guard thing, my wife continually always made sure that she took every opportunity to clean his room, i.e. look through his things, which was a good thing every parent should do, and found a receipt for a bottle of water. And that was it. That was the evidence and the proof that we needed to know that he was using drugs. What? Yeah, a bottle of water, right? Just from East Cleveland. And there was no way that he should have ever been in East Cleveland for any reason. So when he came home, we called him out on the carpet. We didn't ask the question. We made a statement, and we found out that night that he was addicted to heroin. We did what you're supposed to do, which was we didn't know what to do. Spent the next day, well, actually spent about a minute in full relief that now we got this out on the table. And then went into panic mode because I had no idea what to do. Spent the next day on the internet trying to find out what to do. Had all these incredible, I had somebody willing to fly, they were going to fly a private jet from Minnesota, pick him up, take him back to Minnesota. I'm like, well, I don't know that that's the right thing. Finally, I got a hold of somebody that said, hey, bring him in Monday for an evaluation. That made sense, right? Okay, we'll do that. We took him in Monday. He was evaluated, and we were told that he was not a bad heroin addict. Thank you. Exactly what I said. Thank God my kid's not one of those bad heroin addicts. He's a good heroin addict. Hey, okay, so what does it mean? What do we do now? Oh, intensive outpatient treatment, 5 days a week, 4 hours a day, 8 weeks, and he's cured. And so that's what he did. And after the 8 weeks, he was cured. He was healthy. His weight was back. And it was, I will never use drugs again. The dynamic in the house was back. There was you know, for all of you that have lived, you know the chaos that's in the house. And the relationship with his brother was fractured. The relationship with his sister was damaged. Everything in the house was chaos. But he came out healthy. And the house was back to normal. And I can remember standing at the top of the stairs at night and listening to the three of them back down in the basement playing video games and laughing and doing what families do and doing what brothers and sisters do. But what we didn't know and what we really weren't taught and we really didn't grasp was that relapse is not a possibility, it's a probability, because in our country, somewhere between 70 and 90% of the time, somebody goes to treatment, they will relapse. And he relapsed. And this time it was into inpatient treatment, and we did that. And when he came out of inpatient treatment, it was not the I'm healthy, I'm happy, I'll never use drugs again. It was battle royale. It was a fight every single day to say no to that drug that was in his head, saying, come on, you want to, you know you want to do this, right? You know you want to use. And we went through roller coasters that summer. Got to get to a meeting. You have to get, I've been to 5 meetings in a row. Can I take a night off? Oh, well, you've been to 5 in a row. That's good. Yeah, you can take a night off. You've been a good boy. Just things that we didn't know because we weren't continuing to educate ourselves either. We were in the middle of this thing, but we thought we knew what we were doing. My wife went to a couple of support group meetings, couldn't find one that she liked. I didn't need to go to a support group meeting for a family because those things were for weird people, and I was not going to be caught near weird people that had kids that were, it just wasn't for me. I knew what I needed to do. I don't need a support group. What do I need that for, right? I get work. It didn't matter. And I remember that he would say to me, Dad, I didn't ask for this. Dad, I don't want this. I don't know how to beat this. And I would tell him, it's okay, we're going to get through this. We're going to get through this together. And in the back of my mind, I didn't know how. Not only did I did not know how, I was like, I might have to throw you out of the house. You might not be able to live here. At the end of the summer, at the end of July, he received a call from the military and said, we are not going to discharge you. In fact, if you stay clean, we're going to take you to Afghanistan with us because we're leaving November 7th. And he started to work a program as best he could work a program. He always did things his way. It was never by the book, which is probably why our family group runs the way it runs. But it's genetically, you know. But he started to work a program. And it was 30 days no drugs and 60 and 90. And he spent September down in Mississippi training for deployment. His job in the military was the 50 cal machine gun guy on the back of the Humvee. And he came back in October. And it was 100 days and 110 days, 150, 18 days away from deployment. But that drug never leaves their head, and it didn't leave his. And for whatever reason, on that day, that drug said, come on, one more time before you go. And he said yes. And on Friday, October 22nd, I sat in the Olmsted Township Police Department filling out a missing persons report because he had gone missing the night before. And we knew he had relapsed, and he was missing. And as I sat in the Olmsted Township Police Department, Detective Vanya received a phone call. And Chief Minnick came out and asked me to sit with him in the conference room in the back of the police department, which I thought was a weird thing for him to come out and do. And he sat down next to me and he put his arm around me and he said, we just received a call from the East Cleveland Police. And they found your son and I'm sorry to tell you he passed away. So we've run this gamut. We've experienced every element of this addiction with the exception of long-term recovery. And we put together this organization because it was his dream. He had a dream to help educate families, help families understand, help young people understand addiction, and it's kind of turned into us helping families. We have seen this thing destroy a young person. But we also lived with this disease of addiction as it destroyed our family, as it tore our family apart. And in our house, we had Team Rob and we had Team Carla, and we were completely different teams. We were not on the same page. And so as we've gone through this journey and as we've gone through the last 6 years, as we put together our family group, we've learned some lessons that are very important, lessons that we did not know when we sat in the middle of the hurricane, lessons that we should have learned when we sat in the middle of the hurricane. Because the reality of this is that once our kids walk through the door, once they say yes to drugs or alcohol, whatever it is, and they walk through the door of the disease of addiction, there is no prescribed treatment that works. There are things that we know work better than others. And it doesn't matter. All of the treatment centers and all of the A groups and all of the family support groups and all of the addiction support groups and all the it doesn't matter. But what matters is that we try to take as many of the right steps. And one of the things that we've learned that's critically important is that we as families need recovery. We as families, whether we want to admit it or not, are addicts. We are addicted to our addicts. We are addicted to their disease, and we do as many crazy, insane things as we stay addicted to their disease as they do within the confines of the disease. So I want to run through some of the things that we've learned, talk a little bit about addiction, a little bit about enabling, relapse, and family roles, because these are the things that we talk about with our families. And I'm going to run through them real quick, and then we're going to get to question and answer. But this is my question for you. How many of you that have loved ones that are addicted were prepared for that addiction? Any? No? Nobody? How many of you are prepared for recovery and what that means? How many of you are prepared for your own recovery, right? And that's the problem we have to face. What does that really mean? And one of the big things that we face early on relative to this disease, and actually we're going to put a really neat video up, a very short but a really neat video up on our Facebook page, cheap plug for our Facebook page, Facebook / Robbie's Voice. But on Monday we're going to post a very short video from kind of a person of notoriety that had a child go through this, and he says some amazing things in this condensed moment. But part of it is this stigma. Oh my God, what are people going to think because my child's an addict? If it was cancer, leukemia, anything but addiction, right? And we have to deal with this thing called, and the problem is the disease of addiction thrives on stigma. Because the more stigma that infiltrates our family, the quieter we are about it, and the less likely we are to go get the help we need. The less likely we are to reach out to the surrounding family members and say, here's what's going on. So if they come over looking for money or come over looking for this, here's what we need you to do. And what ultimately ends up happening is when they don't get what they want from us at home, they go manipulate somebody else and get what they want. And what our Surgeon General said about stigma was very important, but this last line was really kind of critical. The way we address this crisis is a test for America. Well, that's a big apple to eat. The way we address this crisis is critical for our families here in our communities. Right, I can't comprehend the country. I can comprehend you, and I can comprehend Olmsted Township. Okay, one of the things we always talk to our families about is simply this: right, addiction is not a moral failing. They are not bad kids. They made decisions based on information we did or didn't give them. They made decisions based on information they thought was or wasn't right. Right, they're not getting their information from they're getting it from Yahoo. They're getting it from their friend Jimmy. Right? This is not a moral failing. And when I say this, I want you to think back to when you were 16, 17, and 18 years old. For those of you that are kind of around my age group, and think about the drives to Blossom Music Center, what happened in the car on the way to Blossom Music Center, okay? Think about the things that we did, only it's the drug has changed now, right? It's different. We did a lot of this. So this is not a moral failing. They're not bad kids. This isn't about willpower. So many people still think, you just quit. Just stop. No, it's not about that. It's not about good kids, bad kids. It's not about fate or karma or any of that kind of stuff. This is a disease like any other disease. And if we allow ourselves to be told by all of our friends and relatives, well, I always knew he was a bad kid. I always knew he was up to no good. I always knew this was going to trouble us. Oh, my God, what kind of parent were you? How could you let this happen? And we hear these things, right? We hear these things because people want to pass judgment down upon us. When it's probably happening in their own house and they don't even know it. And we allow the stigma to make us curl up and keep it quiet. We're going to keep it in our house. I'm not going to tell anybody. It's our secret. And when we do that, the disease flourishes. The disease has nothing to do with these things. It is a disease. And once we can start to get by that thought process, then we can start to deal with it and manage it. And one really big thing, once we realize that most every household in the United States of America is dealing with this in one way or another, okay, just put it out there. When, after Robbie passed, I remember, we struggled with this question, how many kids do you have? How do you answer that, right? And my wife, we agreed, we had three. We have three kids. And she would see people in the grocery store, and they would ask the question. She would tell them, this is what happened to our eldest. And 9 times out of 10, the response would be, oh, my God, my nephew, my niece, my son, my daughter, what? You got an organization. Well, do you have a card? Because it's happening in their house as well. We allow stigma to apply on us, all right? So this is what we have to understand. Addiction is a progressive chronic disease of the brain. It's progressive. It gets worse, okay? This is the definition of disease, by the way. The definition of disease is it's progressive. It gets worse. Does addiction get worse? Yes. It's chronic. It's lifelong. It never goes away. It's recurring. It's frequent. This is my favorite part of the definition, though. A disease is a disorder or incorrectly functioning of a body part resulting from a genetic or developmental errors, infection, poison or toxicity, or unfavorable environmental factors. Addiction is a disease. It's something that happens. Our kids will never see it coming. It's a change in the physiology of the brain. Their brain actually changes. It's not willpower. It's not good or bad. It's something that they don't understand, that they can't control. It's no different than diabetes. It's no different than cancer. It is a disease that takes over their brain. And this is the big question, is how long does it last? Well, detox is a couple of days. Treatment, maybe a month at best, if we're lucky and we have a really good insurance company. If we're wealthy, we can go longer, but you know, that whole thing. But addiction itself is a lifelong disease that, if treated every single day, will stay in remission. The question becomes is, are we prepared? Do we know what that means, right? And generally not. We're generally not prepared. We're generally not prepared with how do we deal with addiction. So this plays into the part in a lot of ways with one or both of the parents within the confines of the household. We see one of two things. We either see two enablers or we see one hardliner, my wife, and one enabler, me. Hence Team Robin, Team Carlisle. What was really cool in our house is that we had the three kids, and one of the non-addicted children was on Team Carla, and one of the non-addicted children was on Team Robin. We had good old Donnie Brooks in our house on a regular basis. Enabling, this is the bottom line. You're either going to enable addiction or you're going to enable recovery. One or the other, okay? There's no middle ground here on this, right? So what we've got to understand is enabling is removing the consequences of someone's behavior. Oh, you don't have food? Well, here, let me give you money for food. Oh, you can't pay the rent? Well, let me pay the rent for you. Oh, your car's going to get repossessed if you don't? Well, let me make the payment for you. What happens when we get to the consequence that we can't fix because they've never had to deal with them? I had a mom call me. My son's an addict. What do? We helped her get him into treatment. She called me literally 90 days later. So the treatment was great, and thank you for helping us, and he came out clean, but we don't understand, he relapsed. And we don't get it because we got him a job, and we got him a car. And I said, well, what did he do? Oh, right? Silence. So what we got to understand is once enabling stops, recovery is able to start. Because if enabling is going on, recovery is not happening. And this is, right, you all know the three C's. Once you realize you didn't cause it, you can't control it, you can't cure it, and you can't, thank you, then you understand that the only way to cure this thing is to allow them to deal with it. And this is what we really talk about a lot. When we are working recovery for our addict, not only what are they doing, but who's working recovery for us? When we're working recovery for them, because we want it sometimes worse than they want it, who's working recovery for us? And that's a big problem that we've got to understand, that your happiness must never depend upon your addict. Addiction is an unpredictable disease. There is no guaranteed outcome. And the sad reality of what we're dealing with is we may lose our children. And we have to work our recovery as a family to save the family no matter what happens with the addict, because we didn't cause it. We can't control it. We can't cure it. But we have to learn how to cope with it and deal with it inside the family. The problem is as we deal with it and we go along, we get this little thing right here, this thing called relapse. Now, how many of y'all are prepared for relapse? How many of y'all have been through relapse, right? How many of you were prepared for that little thing there, right? That's a problem, because here we are as a family. We're in recovery and we are celebrating. Right? It's a party. Thank God they are cured. They are healed. No longer an addict. It's a miracle. It's a wonderful thing. And here we go. It's all good. The problem is why we're celebrating. Here's what's going on with our addict. They want recovery. They don't want it. They want sobriety. They don't want to be an addict. Right? And they're celebrating recovery too. And they're excited and they're out of treatment and they're clean and they're feeling healthy like they haven't felt in a long, long time. And they're confident. Well, maybe just hopeful. But yeah, recovery. I can do this. But here's what's going on in their heads, their hearts, and their souls. Fear, confusion, and loneliness. Yeah, I want this, but how am I going to do it? Wait, I got to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm going to be an addict. Oh, boy. That's a heavy load. Man, I got these bills I got to pay. How am I going to get these bills paid? I got this legal thing. God, what am I going to do about this legal thing? How am I ever going to recover from all of this stuff to be able to live a normal life? Oh, I don't have a job. All right, I'm sitting at home. I'm bored. Wait, I can't go hang out with those guys. I'm not supposed to go hang out with those guys because those are the people I did drugs with. I'm going to go hang out with, wait, they don't want to hang out with me because I'm an addict. What do I do? In fact, this is one of the places the church has come in, very, very critical. Faith-based organizations, very, very critical here in getting volunteered involved with those things because we don't judge here in church often. Right? We're supposed to be more accepting. Look, we're not perfect, right? We do the best we can. So while we're celebrating, the addict is having this internal struggle between hope and confidence and fear and lack of confidence, right? And so then we get into this thing called relapse. So this is where we've got to tie relapse back to the fact that this is a disease. If we look at relapse as a verb, you didn't know you were getting a grammar lesson today, did you? And truth be told, I really sucked at grammar in school, so stick with me on this. I'm going to do the best I can. So verb is like this action thing. And if you look at the definition of relapse as a verb, it's to fall or slip back, to fall back, right? It's this action that puts this thing on their shoulders. It's their, oh, they're making choices. Right? How long do they go to rehab for? What, 30 days at a time? How long does it take to get the brain chemistry back to normal? 1 to 3 years, okay? So we send them to treatment for 30 days, 1 to 3 years, so we treat a chronic disease with an acute approach. Oh, now, why doesn't that work? But if we change and we look at this as a noun, the return of a disease or illness after a partial recovery. Once we understand that we're the disease that we're dealing with, the way it works on the brain, the things that they're going through emotionally and mentally, the underlying factors, like what happened that drove you here, and we start to treat this as a disease entity instead of a personal failing, we can start to take control of action plans. We can start to understand what they're going through. It's not necessarily going to prevent a relapse, but it gets us thinking a little bit differently and looking for different signs of relapse. We're actually writing a relapse contract right now. It's for families to sit down with their addicts that are coming out of jail or treatment or wherever they're coming out of from a sober standpoint. And it takes you through the Gorski steps of relapse. And basically what it identifies is in a moment of calm sobriety for both parties, we're going to talk about if we see these signs, what are we going to do? What are we going to do as a family? What are you going to do as an addict? And we're going to create this contract because it's going to help you as a family understand where they are in recovery. It's going to help you be more aware of signs of relapse and then how serious are they about recovery? Because once you identify signs of relapse and you address them, if they're not willing to do the things they need to do to stay sober, they're not really serious about recovery, which then ties into the boundaries you build for yourself on how you're going to live your lives in your homes. So why do addicts relapse? Just real quick, sometimes they make a choice. The reality of it is a lot of addicts coming out of treatment or wherever already know they're going to use again when they come out. There's neglect, okay? They just don't work the steps. They don't go to meetings or they stop going to meetings. And we feel like, well, you know, they've been pretty good about going to meetings. They can take a night off or, you know, it's just a little thing, you know. Or we let them manipulate us again. But basically, they neglect the stops. They got into sobriety by doing this. Well, guess what it takes to stay in sobriety? The same things that got you there are the same things that you need to do to stay there, right? And relapse is a process. Relapse is a process. For those that don't just choose, I'm going to go use, you actually can see it coming, but generally speaking, we're not educated enough to truly, we're either in euphoria ourselves because we've beaten this and we're not going to relapse and we're excited and we just aren't paying attention. But the steps are always there. Things are always there to be seen, and we've got to understand it. But the bottom line is this. No matter what, relapse is a kick in the gut. And it is so critical to be engaged in an FA group, a family group, because if this happens or when this happens, the only people that you can go to that know or understand are the people in that home group, the people that will be there for you, the people that will tell you the truth about what you're thinking, and the people that will hold you up when you need to be held up. We'll talk about that later on. But again, what I want you to understand is just like addiction, relapse, right? You didn't cause it. You can't control it. You can't cure it. But if you're not doing the things you need to do as a family in your family group, you actually can be a part of triggering the relapse. If part of their underlying drivers for addiction are the family dynamic, and we're not working to correct and fix and understand those family dynamics, we can actually be a part of triggering a relapse. Which gets us to our next thing, which is the family. And so many people don't realize this. I didn't truly understand this until we started running the family group. When we talk about the disease of addiction, we are very quick to get treatment and help for the addict. We are not very quick to get treatment and help for the family. And one of the things I think we fail to truly grasp and understand is how many of you take your kids to family group? Okay. Guess what? Your kids feel the same exact feelings and emotions that you do, the same fears, same frustrations, same angers they deal with every single day just like you do. And we're not taking them to a group to help them get that off their chest. And what do we think is going to happen as we move down the road with them? So what we've got to understand is the entire family needs to be involved in a family recovery group, because addiction doesn't just impact the addict. Addiction impacts every single member of the family, okay? And this was our house, right? Somebody's screaming, somebody's yelling, and things were split, right? There's Team Rob, there's Team Carla, and we got the kids split, everybody split. And guess who loves chaos? The addict. Guess who thrives in chaos? The addict, the disease. And why? Because while all the attention's over here on the tension, nobody's paying attention to them, okay? One of the things that we see happen that I truly didn't understand until we started running our own family group are different roles that the siblings of the addicts start to take in the household. Because in our house, all the attention was on Robbie, and it was on saving his life and get him through the addiction. Sound familiar to anybody's houses, right? And so the other siblings are like, yo, right? For us, Nolan and Jacqueline were going into their senior years. Both were all-conference athletes, one in volleyball, one in football, both fall sports, right? So here we are in the midst of this addiction, and they're going into their senior years, captain of the volleyball team, which was, you know, a team that's, you know, going to compete for the conference championship and maybe states, one of the leaders on the football team, all-conference football player, and where's our attention? So they start to take on different roles. It could be the scapegoat, right? And they start to do things just to get in trouble, just to get a little bit of attention. The lost child, right? So they become withdrawn, and they just kind of go away and disappear. The mascot, the cheerleader, rah, 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 everything's okay, and they use that to cope or mask the things that are going on emotionally. They become enablers, or they want to be the hero themselves. Don't worry, Mom, I'll take care. I'll cook dinner. I'll do this. I'll do that. I'll do that. I'm going to do that, right? But then what happens when relapse happens? And one of the things that we don't understand is not only are they going through these things right now, but as they go through these emotional traumas as teenagers or younger, when they get down the road into adulthood, these things affect the way they approach their relationships. We actually see increased divorce rates, increased levels of addiction in kids that had addicts in their family because of the things that they went through and the emotional scars that they developed. So if we're not paying attention to the siblings, if we're not getting the siblings the help that they need, then what are we doing? One of the things that we're working on, I'm very excited about, there's an NA group in Brook Park. They don't follow the rules either. It's one of my favorite groups. But the leader of that group, Kathy Stadahar, has kind of spun off, and we're working with her. She's developing a support group for kids, ages 6 to 12. So it's going to be very exciting, because now you're going to have a place to bring kids where they're going to be able to get this out, and we're going to be able to deal with it and help them deal with this so that we can take a lot of this stuff and get it out on the side so that they can live healthy, normal lives as well. But this is the thing, it's one of my favorite things. Right? We're going through addiction, we're living in the storm. And there's all of these emotions going on for everybody. Just remember, they're going on with your kids as well, because the feelings that we carry forward with us from are with us from our rigid, dysfunctional childhoods driven by our parents. As we're dealing with an addict as parents, the reality of it is whether we want to admit or not, our houses are dysfunctional. Addiction just brings that to the house. And the brothers and the sisters in the houses are going to be products of that dysfunction unless we address it and we deal with it up front. All right, so now what? And we'll finish up with this, and then we'll get to Q&A. But there are no perfect answers. This is like somebody peeled a sticker off the Rubik's Cube and put one color on there that's not actually on the cube, and you're sitting there all like, right? Talking about, whoa, how do we fix that? There are no perfect answers. The perfect answer is prevention. The perfect answer is not being caught in addiction. So there is no perfect answer. So if you're looking for it, you can stop looking for it now. You're going to find it. But the answer lies in what you do and how we approach this. The addict has to find treatment for themselves. The addict has to cope with their addiction. The addict has to own the consequences of their addiction. We cannot recover for them. We have to recognize that we as family members, however, have been impacted by this disease, and we need help, right? We need to do as many of the right things as we possibly can do for our family. Because as we do as many of the right things as we can for our family, it actually drives the addict to turning points. They can no longer manipulate us. They can no longer get money for us. It's the home may not be a welcome place for them anymore to come in and, again, take advantage of our hospitality or to get money from us. The problem with that is it's so contrary to being a parent. The choices and decisions that we have to make when we're dealing with an addict are 180 degrees opposite of our instincts as parents. And that's why FA groups are so critical, because FA groups can bring Team Rob and Team Carla together. They can help us understand the decisions and the ramifications. And there's people in that group that know and understand and will support and help us go through those things. But the most important thing and the most critical reason for groups like FA is simply this. You're not alone. You are not alone as you go through this. And don't ever think that you are, because there is help for you in every step of the way. There's help for your kids every step of the way. What you need to do is take that thing called stigma and ego and pride and ignorance and put them on the shelves and find and accept the help and the support, because it is definitely out there. So that is it. We are actually pretty close to on schedule, so we'll go to Q&A time.
Thank you.
Can you use the...